Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 2 for Autumn Semester 2012. Lecture 7, delivered on September 12, 2012. The title of this lecture is Accounting in Finance.
Today, Accounting in Finance. And I'll begin this with a couple of questions just to have you show me how incredibly intelligent you are when it comes to accounting. And these are, there's more of a common sense kind of thing, but you have to think about it for a second. Okay, I have paid off a bond issue of $100 million. I paid the coupons, I did everything right, and now it's time to pay off the face value of this debt issue that I had done 20 years ago. Okay, I paid off the bonds. Is that a source of cash or a use of cash when I pay off a bond? Remember, it's not going to show up in the income statement. Retiring a bond will not show up in the income statement, but it is a source or a use of cash. Which is it? If I pay off a bond, what would you say? Yeah.
Use.
That's right. I'm paying money, it's coming out of my pocket, so that's a use. Even though I won't see it in the income statement, and therefore it's not in the net income line, it's something that I'm going to have to adjust for. $100 million just came out of my pocket. Okay. My accounts receivable have fallen in the current year. Now, that won't show up on the income statement either, so it's not going to be in the net income, so I'm going to have to make an adjustment for that. My accounts receivable fell. Is that going to be a source of cash or a use of cash that I, as a finance person, have to recognize?
A source.
Yes, because apparently some of my deadbeats paid me off. So my accounts receivable went down. So it looks like assets going down is a source of cash. And it looks like liabilities going down is a use of cash. Now, honest, swear to you, when I did accounting, there's tables you can remember. Assets going down is a source of cash. Liabilities going down. Really, I always just thought about it in the common sense way. I never tried to memorize which way it went with liabilities and assets. I just thought about, okay, that went down. So, okay, now let's say that my wages payable has increased. Would that be a source or a use of cash if wages payable on the balance sheet went up in the current period?
Use.
That would be a use? Okay. I said on my income statement I paid you. So I took that off, and that's down. Net income went down because of that. But my wages payable went up. In other words, I didn't pay you. I just said I did. So what would that be something, a source of cash or a use of cash? Think about it. If I said, yeah, it's a source because I said I paid you, I took it off my net income from the money that came down to the net income. So at the end of the day, if that went up in the balance sheet, I'd say as a finance person, aha, that means that I have to add that back in to my net income after the net income because I didn't really pay it. So there you go. Liabilities going down is a use of cash. Liabilities going up is a source of cash. If you think about it that way, it makes it a lot easier. I just did my IPO. An IPO, the proceeds will not show up on an income statement. But I've done an IPO. What would you say? Is that a source or a use of cash? I just sold a buttload of stock. Okay, is that... Good. That's it. It's like common sense. You just sold stock. Money came into the bank. That doesn't show up on the income statement, but it sure is a lot of money. You know, You got paid under the table for work you did. You're not going to tell the IRS about it, are you? Oh, yeah, you will. Yeah, sure. Lying mofo. Yeah, you're not going to. And so it's a source that isn't reported in your income. So I have to add it back in when I audit your ass, okay? Just think about it that way. I'm going to give you a quiz to take home for the weekend just to get some numbers down. And there's a little place on there where I list some things that have happened. And all I want you to do is give me a plus or minus. Is it an addition to cash or a depletion of cash, a source or a use? And really, it's not that hard once you get the hang of it. Although sometimes I still get screwed up with some of these bizarre transactions that come around. Now, I'm going to get down to the meat of a problem here in a few minutes. But first thing I want to do is talk about taxes for a while. I want to talk about taxes here. One of the most boring subjects that you could ever imagine until, you know, it's all fun and games until the IRS comes with their guns out. So let's find out what taxes are all about. And I'm going to do this in a... I'm going to give you a little bit more expanded concept of taxes here. First of all, taxes come in all flavors and varieties. But I can pretty much break taxes down structurally into three categories. And there is some misunderstanding and misnaming of taxes. The simplest tax in the world, the simplest, is what is called a flat tax. A flat tax. You exist. Yeah, you do. And we won't dispute that. Let's not get into philosophy. We're not drunk, okay? So you exist. Therefore, you owe me $500. That's a flat tax. A flat tax is just a block of money. Sometimes you'll hear a proportional tax set called a flat tax. They're very different. A flat tax is just simply a plug of money. Now, interestingly enough, back in the day when I was in the economics PhD program at Ohio State, it was pretty much ruled by these radical right-wing economists of various flavors. There were libertarian, rational expectations, hardcore conservative. And when we were taught all the theory of economic behavior, there was this constant harp that taxes harm. Taxes hurt economies. And there should be no taxes. But if we're ever going to have a tax, the one that does not distort flows of capital would be a flat tax. So obviously we should just go to a flat tax. Everyone in the United States pays a flat amount of money, and that's what our tax system would be. Of course, that sucks when you don't make a lot of money. It's wonderful when you make buttloads of money. Sounds, you know, flat taxes sound, you know, like that. Well, they're not all that fair to the poor. Well, in fact, flat taxes are an extraordinarily common way of raising revenue in the United States. Your driver's license is a flat tax. Your license plates for your car are a flat tax. Hunting license, all kinds of licenses that you would get are nothing but flat taxes. It doesn't matter how much you make. It doesn't matter the value of the service that you are getting. It's just a flat amount of money. And therefore, it is essentially a regressive tax on income. In other words, it doesn't hurt you as much when you make more money. We like to say that in the United States we have a progressive tax system. But in fact, flat tax and the next tax I'm going to show you are both actually regressive. So a lot of the tax that is embedded in the American system of taxation is not progressive at all. It is in fact regressive on income. Flat taxes are obviously regressive on income because a person who does not make a lot of money pays the same amount as a person who makes a lot of money for a driver's license. Therefore, it hits the poor harder than it hits the middle class, and it hits the middle class more than it hits the wealthy. Same is true of a lot of other taxes, and you can probably think of on your own of a lot of flat taxes that you encounter in your normal life, in your daily life. So there you are, flat tax, just a block of money. And they are very, very common in the United States. The next type of tax, and it comes in various flavors, is the proportional tax. Often, I'm amazed at how many people use misname proportional taxes, flat taxes. And they are promoted from time to time as the solution to all of our problems, as far as our budgets go and our taxation goes. Now, the best example, the classic example that you could think of a proportional tax would be a sales tax. It's just a proportion of the revenue. In Europe, much of European tax overall is actually a proportional tax called a VAT, a value-added tax. Basically, it works sort of like this, and you don't have to write this down. I'm just going to show you how the European system and other parts of the world do taxes. Suppose that you're a manufacturer. You extract at your first stage of production, stage one, and here on this column in the middle, I'm going to put the incremental value added. Okay? Now, at stage two, you've extracted resources. There was $1,000 worth of value. Let's tax that at 10%. So you have there $100 you pay to the government. Now, at stage two, you have turned that raw resource into something that is worth, let's say, $15,000. So your increment on that, $1,500. Okay. So your increment is $500. You've added $500 of value in that stage of production. You shook out all the impurities from the raw resource, and now it's in a refined state, and it's worth $1,500. So the added value is $500, and let's say that that tax at that stage is, oh, let's say 5%. So at that stage, you have another $25 of tax you pay. Now let's say that that is turned into, let's say, sheet metal at the third stage of production, and that sheet metal has a value on the market of $4,000. So in other words, we have added $2,500 of value incrementally at that stage, and let's say that the tax at that stage is 20%. So at that stage, you have a $500 value-added tax. And let's just stop it there. You can go through a lot of stages of production. So the total amount of tax that is collected is $625 through the stages of production. It's a proportional tax, but it pops at every stage of the production. So by the time it gets to the end user, a consumer in a household or a business, which would have to pay its own end tax, you've got a lot of tax that's been generated. Now, the attractiveness of this is that there's kind of an opacity. You can't really see it at the consumer level. You might see a little bit of a final value added tax, but it doesn't look like much tax happened at all. Whereas, in fact, that production process was being bled at every stage by the tax that was being applied at that stage. By the time it's over with, the company that was doing this or the companies that were involved in the various stages of production have paid to the government of that country a lot of money, quite a bit of money, but it doesn't seem like it to the average consumer. They don't see the VAT. That's why you would see, for example, on the income state, on the financial statements of ExxonMobil, you would see that there was not a lot of tax paid at the bottom line. But then you would see disclosures for staggering amounts of taxes because they would disclose in the notes to the financial statement, oh, well, we paid all of these incremental taxes that were embedded in the price at the next stage of production. So we go back and calculate that, and what looks like very low taxes for the corporation turn out to be large taxes, huge taxes, but you don't see it because it was actually just part of the expense along the way. It was just part of the expense that you recognized up higher in the income statement, not down there at the bottom line. So always be careful when you look at the income tax taxes paid line. Right after EBT, earnings before taxes, taxes, sometimes a lot of the tax was paid up there and it's hidden in the expenses section of the income statement. Okay, that's a proportional tax. But most of us are not familiar with that at all. Our idea of a proportional tax is actually a value-added tax at one stage, the final stage. If it is a one-stage, final-stage value-added tax, we call it a sales tax. The classic in the United States is a sales tax as a proportion of the amount of the retail sale itself. And you can have several different stacks of that. For example, when I sell product here in Illinois for my company, I have a tax that applies. The state has a tax, and then the city has a tax. However, it gets really complicated, and let me tell you, this is a pain in the ass for online, for e-commerce, is that some of my products are exempt from state tax because they're art, but they're not exempt from local tax. Some of my products are not exempt from either tax. So it gets rather complicated when you're trying to write a program that will recognize the tax on a purchase. So I sell a print, and that would not be taxed at the state level, but it would be taxed at the local level. If I sell one of my books, it's taxed at the state level and at the local level. And so, anyway. Okay, sales tax. Let me bring up very important point that's an economics point and something that we have to think about in finance as well, about proportional taxes. In order to do this, I have to bring up something from psychology, just a basic idea. Have any of you ever heard of Maslow's hierarchy of needs? Some of you have. Okay, it works like this. There was a psychologist named Maslow, and he said, okay, in our lives, the needs that we fulfill are like a wedding cake. We fulfill really basic needs first, and then once we got those kind of covered, then we fulfill needs that are a little more refined, higher needs. Once we fulfill those, we fulfill some needs that are kind of higher than that. Okay, now in Maslow's hierarchy, down here at the bottom, your basic needs in life are food and sex. Now, that does not mean pizza and ass. It means, well, yeah, it does mean pizza and ass. Okay, whatever. You got to eat. And you got to... God damn, it's hot in here. Okay, now once you've got that one covered, once you've got your food and you've gotten some butt, and you go up, or hand for you guys. That was hurtful. You got shelter and safety would be next. So in other words, you get some chow, you get some ass, and then you find a place you can lock and you got a gun for when her boyfriend shows up. And then we go up here, group affiliation, then place within the group, all these higher, higher needs until you get up to the top tier, self-actualization. But first we have to satisfy our basic needs. And we all have the same basic needs. I don't care what anyone says. It can be a Buddhist monk, a Presbyterian minister, or some guy just hanging out looking creepy at the party. We all need food and we all need sex. Don't lie. You do.
No, I don't want no food. Oh, I don't want that party over there. Girls going wild.
No, you do. Don't lie. So the point here is for finance and economics thinking is that we all have to cover the basic needs. Now, the truth of the matter is that we can all eat ramen noodles. We can all eat Spam. We can all have ugly sex. We might not like it, but it's there, man. And when it's lonely and you're hungry, what the hell? But you see, that's the whole point of what I'm getting to here, is that I don't care if you're some street person or if you're some rich man like George Soros, you have the same basic needs and the same essential amount of expenditure. You can spend more if you want to, but there's a certain amount you have to for the basic needs to keep body and soul together. $10 for food, $25 for butt, whatever. It's there. So, in other words, suppose that we have two people. You are miserably poor. You're down and out. You work at Lowe's Home Furnishings in the light bulb section. I mean, when it comes to light bulbs, you're the boss. You know light bulbs. Now, you make $20,000 a year. And I'll give you, I'll just put a generic name for you. Loser. You are a rich son of a bitch. You make lots of money. You hang out with Mitt Romney. Okay? Ew. Oh, it's cool, you know, you sit in the sauna together talking about, you know, things, guy things, you know. And you're the winner, and you make $2 million a year. Okay, now, you, and I have found this out about people, I traveled in a very rich crowd. I mean, real rich people. Not, you know, well, I make $200,000 a year. These were people, their kids would take a flight on a private jet to Paris for a dinner sometimes. It was that kind of rich people. And they swore they had to have better food, better clothes, better place. Oh, my stomach couldn't take, you know, that kind of food like you eat. You know, White Castles, that would give me diarrhea. Yeah, it gives me diarrhea too. What the hell, you know? Chow down. It's the 30 pack. Okay, but at the end of the day, they would think that they need more, but they don't need more. They want more, they get more, but they don't need more. Maslow was clear. It's not Chateaubriand and fancy butt. It's Spam and naked ass. So, the point here is that these two people are going to need the same amount of money to fulfill fundamental need. Let's say that it's $2,000 a year, whatever. $2,000 a year, both of them have to live, to survive. Whatever either of them spends above that is just their want, not their need. Okay, now,
let's look. And let's say that those basics have a sales tax of, let's say, 5%. sales tax on consumption items is 5%. Now, it might be less, it might be more. It doesn't matter. The example will hold. Now, so we're going to look at the tax on this person's food would be $100. And the tax on this person's basic needs would be $100. Now for the kicker. The income tax rate. If we look at this as a part of income, for the loser, it's $100 of a $20,000 income. For the winner, it's $100 of a $2 million income. So let's look at the tax rate as an income tax that each of these people is paying. And if I do that, just make sure that the number will stagger you. 100 divided by $20,000 should be a 0.5% tax. Income tax. But $100 on a $2 million income is a 0.0005. Actually, 0.005. Let me write this one as a decimal. Oops. 0.5%, 0.5%, 0.005%. And so here's the famous saying, a proportional tax on sales is a regressive tax on income. That's what this was about, is to show you that a proportional tax on sales is always a regressive tax on income. In other words, it is a steeper tax rate on the poor than on the rich. Always. What looks like the fairest tax of all, just a sales tax. We should change our tax system to a sales tax. Everyone just pays a proportion of sales. That would deter consumption, encourage investment. Clearly, they're right about that, but they also avoid the plain, obvious fact that it is a regressive tax on income. Any sales tax is a regressive tax on income. Just like a flat tax is a regressive tax on income, a proportional tax is a regressive tax on income. A proportional tax on sales is a regressive tax on income. Okay. So in other words, we've hit two of the three types of taxes that are out there. Ow, damn. And we have seen that they are both regressive on income. So we go to our federal tax system in this country, and it has been this way since the very beginning of income taxes, federal income taxes, officially, the official beginning, back long, long time ago, more than a century ago. We have had a progressive tax at the federal level. So I had, I erased this, flat, proportional, and then at the top end, we can have just a straight progressive regressive tax. In other words, the tax rate on income changes as the amount of income changes. Now, we use a system called marginal tax rates, and ours is a progressive system. In other words, as you become richer, your tax rate on the last dollar of income gets larger. There have been around for a long time economists who have argued that we should have a regressive federal income tax. In other words, as your income goes up, your taxes should go down. And the argument is that that would encourage you not to be poor. I kid you not. A Nobel Prize winner named Milton Friedman actually promoted the concept of a regressive tax for many years, saying, look, we are rewarding the poor by giving them a lower tax rate than the rich. We should be punishing them so that they want to make more money. Okay, anyway, I won't say anything more about that, dumbass. But here we go. Okay, now let me show you a simple progressive tax. But understand this, that I'm going to show you a simple example of a progressive tax and show you how you calculate the tax in this environment. And this is sort of like a microscopic view of our tax system. Now, you can have a lot of tiers of income, but let's do this. Let's do one like this. And I'll just use some easy terminology. Last income tax rate. And we call this the marginal tax rate. Okay, so suppose that we had, for the first $0 to $10,000 of income that you made, your tax rate was, on that income, is 5%. Now, let's say that from $10,001 up to, let's say, $30,000, your tax rate is 10%, and above $30,000, your tax rate is 15%. That's a simple three-tier tax system. Ours, in the real world, at the corporate level, I'll talk about that too. But in the real world, we have had periods where there were, I think the most tiers we had at one point was 37 tiers. We reduced it dramatically, the number of tiers, down to 6. And I believe, and then it kind of fluctuated, but we don't have that many tiers anymore. But we still have these tiers of income, and there are 6. And you'll see in corporate, and I'll show you that online later, the corporate tax structure right now doesn't have all that many tiers in it. Now, interestingly enough, what we care about most in finance and in economics is what is the top marginal tax rate, because that is the one that is argued to be the most important on whether a person chooses to earn another dollar. The argument is that if the top marginal tax rate is very high, you don't have much incentive to earn that dollar. If almost all that dollar were going to be taken away from you, you would not want to earn that dollar. That's why the argument among conservatives is that the top marginal tax bracket should be low. Historically speaking, most of the time that there's been a federal tax, up until the time of the Kennedy administration, the top marginal tax rate was 90%. In other words, super rich people, on the last millions they earned, paid 90% of it in taxes. That became lower and lower until we get to the Reagan administration, where it broke below 40%, and it has never seen above that since then. There is a proposal in Congress to drop that marginal tax rate on the richest money, on the highest earning money, down even lower. Now, that seems logical, but there's actually another side to the story. It goes to a theoretical versus real world thing that's a constant fight in finance and economics. The marginal utility of the last dollar. You're walking down the street with Bill Gates. Yeah, you're friends, you know. Go back way, way, way back. Used to throw around ideas, and you know, you went your way and invented a few things. Bill Gates went his way and stole a few things, and it all worked out for everyone. But you're walking down the street, and a $100 bill goes flop, 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 flop by you in the wind. Okay, now, what is it going to be? Are you and Bill going to fight each other to get that dollar bill, or is Bill going to go get it, and you're just, I don't want that? Or are you going to go get it while Bill stands there and watch you get hit by a car? Meh, meh, ding, 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 ding.
I'm going to go dive.
You're going to dive. Is Bill Gates going to go after that $100 bill? No, $100 is what he makes in 1 second. Okay? Logically, there is a diminishing marginal utility to money. In other words, a rich person doesn't get as much out of the last dollar he earns as a lower income person does. That is why we argue that a progressive tax system is okay. Is because, look, these people who make all the scads of money, you know, they're making $250 million a year. Really, are they going to get all that much use out of the last couple of bucks they earn? Well, the answer most people would say is probably not. Their advocates would argue, oh yeah, because that's going to make jobs. So you have to decide which way you buy it. But let's look at the tax here. Suppose that you've been given a raise. You now make $24,000 a year. Let the good times roll. Okay, let's see what your tax is. Okay, well, we would have to say that your first $10,000, which leaves you with $14,000, is going to be taxed at 5%. So the first money that you'll earn, that $10,000, you're going to pay $500 in tax. Now that leaves this $14,000 here, and I would look, okay, that is in the $10,000 to $30,000 range. So that is going to be taxed at 10%. So that is going to be $1,400 more? So your total tax bill is going to be $1,900 because you rode the first tier clear through and you popped into the second tier of income. So your final tax bill will be $1,900. That's how what you see on income on the taxes line in financial statements. That's how you are paying taxes when you pay taxes to the federal government. Usually the state is like a proportion or something like that. City is almost always a proportional tax. But when you look at your tax tables, all they're doing is showing you the result of the marginal tax rate effect through all these income brackets up to the one you need to look at for your taxable income. But you're, in this case, going to pay 15%. Now let's look at someone who makes, let's say, $45,000 a year. Now that person would blow through the first $10,000, whoops, $10,000, at 5%. Okay, and that would mean that, just like you, he pays $500. And then that leaves $35,000 remaining. Okay, now $20,000 of that is going to be in the 10%. So that would be $2,000 there, and that leaves $15,000 in the top marginal tax bracket of 15%, and that's going to be $6,250, is it? I so suck at math.
What's 15% of $15,000? Times 0.15.
$2,250. I was thinking that was too high. $2,250.
So we got $500 that he got dinged on the first tier. Add to that $2,000 because they blew through the second tier. And so, and then you wrote out $2,250 in the third tier. So all told, $4,750. Okay? Now let's, one last thing about this. Is the marginal tax rate on this person right here, on the first person, was 15%. Let's look at his average tax rate, which most people think about when they talk about taxes. The average tax rate he paid was $1,900 on $24,000 of income. $1,900 on $2,400 of income comes out to be $24,000 of income, is a 7.9% average tax rate. Interesting. The average tax rate is always going to be lower, at best the same as the marginal tax rate. Notice that the last dollar he earned was at 10%, but overall his average was a little less than 7.9%. Let's look at this guy over here. You got $4,750 in taxes on $45,000 of income. Okay, notice that his last dollar he earned had a tax of 15%. The marginal tax rate was 15%. But the average tax rate, 4750 divided by 45,000, is 10.56%. Again, the average is less than the margin. This is always going to be the case. So when you talk about taxes, there are two different animals involved. There's an average tax rate, which is just how much you pay in taxes divided by how much you made. And then there is a marginal tax rate, which is how much you're paying on the last dollar. In corporate taxes, and again, I will show you this online in the next lecture just briefly. In corporate taxes, you can see a company that pays a rather low average tax rate, but it could still be in a high marginal tax bracket, depending upon how the system works. Now, for the purposes of this course, I'll ask you some kind of quick question on calculating a tax bill, giving you a simple tax, progressive tax system like this. But in typical problems that we do in finance, especially at the early level, all we ever do is just say, use the average tax rate. Average tax rate, 35%. We don't have you beat you up with doing marginal tax rate analysis and all that. Now, before I get to the last part of this lecture, just as a real-world thing that's going on, conservatives in Congress are proposing that the tax system in the United States be changed so that there would be only two tiers. In other words, it would get almost to be a proportional tax system under proposals that are now in the House of Representatives. There's resistance in the Senate to doing that, and there is major resistance at the executive level to going to that route. But the bottom line is, first of all, the number of tiers over the past half century or so has been going down. Like I said, it was in the Franklin D. Roosevelt's administration, there were like 37 tax tiers. That became much,
much fewer. I believe it got down to 4 in the 1990s, and now it's 6, if I'm not mistaken, for personal taxes and for corporate taxes. But there has been a tendency downward in the number of tiers. In other words, moving more and more, historically we can see it happening, moving away from a theory of progressive taxation to a theory and application of a proportional tax. And as I had pointed out, the closer you get to a proportional tax, the more you're talking about essentially a regressive income tax. It becomes almost regressive in that regard. Because even if you're taxing proportionately on income, lower income people and corporations would end up paying more of their money that they need in taxes. If I'm a small business person and I'm making my revenues in my business for this year are $20,000, let's say that I paid a proportional tax of 20% on $20,000. My taxable income in my little business, my photography business, is $20,000. And let's say that my tax rate is a simple 20%. That means that I pay a simple tax, just a straight up tax, of $4,000. So my net, that would be EBT, that would be tax, so my net is 16 grand. It seems as fair can be that a company that was also in my business that was much, much larger, let's say that it had revenues of $2 million. And they pay 20% tax. Fair is fair. We pay the same tax rate. So they pay $400,000 in tax. They have $1,600,000 left. Fair is fair, except not, because we both have fixed expenses that have to be done. And the fixed expenses for me are going to be a larger proportion of my revenues than they are for this company to stay in business. Now, they may have big fixed expenses, but that's a choice. At the bottom line, both of us have fundamental fixed expenses. And so me living with mine is going to be a lot harder than them living with theirs. Their choices are restricted by this tax. My needs as a business are harmed by this tax. So always keep that in mind when you hear proposals for simple proportional taxes. That's not so simple, and that will hurt smaller businesses disproportionately over larger businesses. Moving on to the last thing I'm going to do for you here. Let me show you something. I'm going to get off this tax thing now and just get back to some basic accounting stuff. And I'm going to lay out sort of a table for you and show you how you put together some financial information if it's not there for you, how you use financial information that you have and use some of the identities of accounting to get yourself to where you want to be. Let's put down a few things here. I'm going to put down revenues, expenses, net income. And I'm going to list retained earnings. January 1, in other words, your beginning retained earnings. And then I'm going to just throw things around a bit. I'm going to put dividends paid,
And then I think I'll put retained earnings.
And these are kind of out of order, but that's okay. We'll figure out what's going on. Earnings, December 31.
In other words, what was the final amount that was added to shareholders' book in the company? Okay, now let's just put in current assets, non-current assets.
And I'll put, just as a side note here, these are at the end of the year. It's really, I don't want to confuse you by putting that December 31 there, but it's just the end of the year balance sheet entries, these are. It's not, you just kind of know those are at the end of the year kind of thing. Total assets. December 31. And then current liabilities, non-current liabilities. December 31. Non-current liabilities. December 31. I want you to write these down, and then I'm going to put this up on an overhead here. But I want you to be able to write them down, have a minute to. I hate it when someone puts something up on an overhead, and you're expected to write all of the information down while the overhead's there for like 5 seconds. So I want you, I'm just writing these down here for you to get down. And then your total liabilities. December 31, then we'll have a few last entries here. And then your capital, common stock and capital in excess of par. In other words, I'm throwing those two together that I talked about the last time. And then your total shareholders' equity. I'm going to give you a chance to write those down while I fire up, and I'll do this on the overhead here. There you go. Let me turn down a light up here on the front. That didn't work. Ah, there we go. Okay. Now, this isn't calculus, but it can drive you crazy if you don't watch what, just think about the fundamental formulas that drive accounting statements. So, the first thing you would ask yourself is, well, okay, what am I supposed to do? I've got these numbers, but some of them are missing, and you want me to fill them in, and the answer is, yeah. So, let's talk about what these numbers look like. Okay, it would be great if I could get net income, But I can't do that because I don't have the expenses. So I can't take revenues minus expenses to get net income. So all I can say there is FTS. We'll go on to something else. Okay, well, let's see. I'm looking around here, and honestly, this is how I do this, is how you'll probably do it too. You'll think to yourself, the first thing you'll ask is something philosophical like WTF. And then after that, you'll say, okay, let's see if we can put together this puzzle. Okay, total assets. Well, I can't do that one either because I could take current and non-current to get total. I don't have that one. What the hell else can I do here? Okay, how about liability? Ooh, well, spank me Jesus. I've got the total liabilities, and I have the current liabilities. So that means that the non-current I can get. Well, at least I won't get a zero on this damn homework. So what's this number going to be right here? Well, there we go. You see how I got that? Okay, so finally we've got something put together. Well, let's see. I know that capital stock plus the ending retained earnings, this is how much they got in retained earnings, their accumulation of retained earnings at the end of the year. Add that to the capital stock and the additional paid in capital, that's total shareholders equity. So I know, okay, I should be able to say the ending retained earnings, $270,000, plus the common stock, $520,000, that should come up to be, what the hell should that come up to be? Yeah, I could have done that. Just let off it. I can do that. Quit it. Yes. Now, if I make a mistake, tell me. I so suck at arithmetic, it's pathetic. Okay, we're good. Now we're beginning to get someplace. We're beginning to put things together. Okay, let's go back up here. Okay, look. Now, retained earnings at the beginning. Remember that retained earnings at the end? Retained earnings and should equal retained earnings at the beginning. Now, I was just testing your ass to see if you could see what isn't there at the beginning. Sorry about that. Plus net income minus dividends. Okay. I got retained earnings at the beginning. You see them? $300,000. So I know, and I got the retained earnings at the end. So $270,000, the retained earnings at the beginning. I'm going to have to back this off a little bit. I can tell that right now. Boy, that almost made me hurl when it did that. There we go. Okay, I know that the retained earnings at the end was... at the end was $270,000. You see that? Well, I also know that should equal the retained earnings at the beginning, which was $300,000, plus the net income, which I don't know, minus the dividends I do know. So again, what I've done here, and I do apologize, this kind of sucks. As a matter of fact, let me write it here real quick. I'm going to write on another piece of paper because I thought I had more room here and I don't. The retained earnings at the end are the retained earnings at the beginning plus net income minus dividends. Okay, so I'm going to write that right here. so you can see it a little better, okay? And so I know that the retained earnings at the end were $270,000. That should equal the retained earnings at the beginning, which were $300,000, plus, but I don't know the net income, but I do know the dividends were $70,000. So I have just one thing I don't know in that little arithmetic equation there. I know that 270, working it out over here, 270,000 should equal 300 minus 70, or $230,000 plus net income. So that means that if I solve for net income, I should be able to come up with what? $40,000, is it? $40,000 is my net income. So I can put down the net income now is $40,000. But that means I can back up to the expenses, because $200,000 minus the expenses is $40,000. So that means that my expenses must have been $160,000, because that's the only way I can get down to that net income line. $200,000 minus $160,000 makes $400,000. Okay, now, where do we go from here? I need my total assets. But I know that total assets are total liabilities plus shareholders' equity, which I call owners' equity. Again, I know that total assets equals total liabilities plus owners' equity. Which means that if I look at this, my total assets, I don't know, but I know my total liabilities are $140,000, and my owner's equity totals $790,000. So I know that my total assets would have to be $930,000. And then I can finally say, okay, current assets plus non-current assets equals total assets. So I've got 80,000 plus something equals 930,000. I'm having a real brain fart. Oh, okay, yeah, okay. God, don't get old. Shoot yourself before you get to be my age. I just switched off there. Okay, now, why would this be important for you to know? Because I've just given you, I'm going to have you pick up a quiz on your way out. You just did half the damn first page. Okay? So you better have written it down right. And if I made a mistake, you better correct it. The other side, by the way, you'll have to do another puzzle. Now, hear me out here. This is a group project. Use as many as 5 people, put the names down, and turn in one for the group. Damn it. Don't do this on your own. That makes my grading a lot longer. Now let me put these up here. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.